Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in National Security, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kyle Beadle, and today we'll be talking to Professors Shtin Runing, Olivier Schmidt, and Amalie Chusen from the University of South Denmark, all of whom are editors of a new book entitled Wartime, Temporality and the Decline of Western Military Power. Thank you all for joining me here today.
It's great to be here.
And since we have a little bit of a panel here, would you mind introducing yourselves and your background?
Ladies first, Amalie.
All right. Well, my name is Amalie Theusen, and I'm an assistant professor at the Center for War Studies at the University of Southern Denmark. And my research mainly focuses on the changing character of war, so the question of how war has changed over the last couple of decades and what that does to the norms that we have on how and when we fight. So which rules do we adhere to when we fight? Do the rules still fit these type of questions? And I also do a little bit on Baltic Sea security and Danish security policy and German security policy in that region.
I guess I'll go next. My name is Olivier Schmidt. I'm a professor with special responsibilities, again, at the University of Southern Denmark, the Center for War Studies. And I'm working on alliances, coalitions, and contemporary warfare, especially the impact and the issues of the main strategic issues. And I'm also right now doing a some work, I hope, on military innovation and military adaptation, trying to provide a framework on how to understand military change. And currently, I'm speaking to you from Paris because I'm in secondment from SDU, so the University of Southern Denmark, to the French Institute for Higher National Defense Studies, which is basically the French equivalent to the National Defense University in the US or the Royal College of Defense Studies in the UK. So I'm in secondment there for 2 years as Director of Research and Studies.
And my name is Shtin Runing, and I am a professor of war studies, also at the University of Southern Denmark. And my research has focused for a good number of years on NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, its crisis management operations in the Balkans. And when NATO then went to Afghanistan, I followed in terms of research and have been tracing why is it so easy to get in and hard to get out? And the same in Libya. And why is NATO not getting into Syria? And so that was at least my background for getting into the questions that we raise in this book.
And how did y'all all come to this project? Where does this collection kind of fit into current literature?
Well, if I can take a first stab at that, I think we have all worked on the main concepts that are associated with Western forces. And they focus on technology, they focus on speed, superiority, quick wins, shock and awe. And really a number of concepts that that demonstrate ability to win. But that was not what we were observing. We observed drawn out wars. NATO forces are still in the Balkans. We've forgotten about that. You know, obviously still in Afghanistan, though they're leaving, but they're not winning, and so forth. And we saw this as a paradox, and we wanted to get into it and find ask some broader questions as to why does this paradoxical situation happen.
If I may jump in as well. So Shtin described the overall objective of the book, but I think we did not arrive at the book itself immediately, because originally we intended to actually try to write a handbook and trying to collect, as Shtin mentioned, the different concepts that are guiding Western warfare. And it's when, you know, we're in the process of saying, okay, where do we go with the handbook? How does it fit into the literature? That we realize that actually we did not want to write a handbook at all. What we're interested in was actually to try to criticize and put those concepts into context and try to find an overarching and maybe also underlying issue that might have helped explain why the West, despite its material superiority and its proliferation of intellectual activities when it comes to concept creation, was still not, or at least was not really effective in modern warfare. So the project kind of evolved over time, and it's also through discussions with people from Chatham House that we refined what became this ultimately an edited volume. But originally we wanted to write a handbook, and we realized it's not where we want to go in the end.
And now I'm jumping in because it's quite interesting, as Olivier rightly put it, that it developed over time. And I think over time in our discussions, we ended up that time is actually the factor that connects all of these concepts and that then contributes to how and why the West is perceived to be in decline, and why at least the jury is out on what's going on there, right? And how these dynamics interact. And I think we ended up, even though we set out with a slightly different goal, we ended up with a very interesting volume. And exactly based on these discussions that we had, we actually understood that time in its different conceptions is what matters here, and how time sort of plays out in the West, but also is understood within the West and is then sort of contrasted within the West in its different understandings of norms, for example, and the way of how we approach warfare. So, I think we settled on time through time in a way.
And what was the process of collecting these essays together?
So, as the book emerged in our thinking, mm-hmm. we started looking at dividing up, you know, what are the key pieces of this, and you know, as we zoomed in on the core question, why is the West so powerful and yet strategically so fragile? And we could look at the literature that has a lot of answers to this, which deals really with, you know, why do the small and weak win wars? There's a literature on that, and which is about these small actors or asymmetric actors being smart. But we felt that we lacked answers when it came to the West itself. What is happening within the West that is making it so ill-disposed to deal with these asymmetric actors? And as we grappled with the core pieces, we settled on, well, there's a political piece to this. Something is going on politically in the West. And that became my basket. And there's something about the way we understand law and norms and the distinction between peace and war. That became Amelie's piece. And then finally, there's something about the way we do military operations and battle. And that became Olivier. We needed a French to cover that because, you know, they're the hot-blooded Latins.
I think also in terms of process itself, once we had settled on the three sections of the book, each of us could collect and contact specific authors. And we organized two workshops, one at Yale University, which was facilitated by one of our colleagues, James Rogers, who was a visiting fellow there. And so he organized a one-day workshop on the ideas on the book, which allowed us to basically test the overall framework. And we had an author's workshop at Chatham House in London, because the book is co-published by Chatham House and Brookings Institution Press. And so having this workshop in London, you know, helped refine what exactly we wanted to get from the authors, and make sure that there was a consistency in the overarching themes that they were addressing, basically making sure that they were answering the advices and indications that we had given them. So, I mean, if it's possible, I'd just like to give a shout out to James to Yale University and also to Chatham House, and because they also made this book possible, in a sense.
So before we get into the individual sections, there are three kind of three words that I'd kind of like for you to define: trajectories, perceptions, and temporalities. And if you could just tackle that and tackle those in relation to wartime, because those are really three of the major themes that kind of come through.
Okay, so I can do trajectory, and then I'll leave the two other concepts to my co-authors. Trajectory is really about the Western self-image as being a force of progress, that the West politically represents a progressive move toward a better tomorrow. And so when we fight wars, we fight wars for progress, to create a better world. And we tend to see the West as not only a force for good, but also as a community of nations that through centuries have become stronger and have become the centerpiece of international order, so that war, not only for ourselves, but for the international order, has come to represent something we fight for progress. And it is this sense that we are powerful, and when we fight for a better tomorrow, that is really put at the test through these wars that we examine. And then I'll leave the other two concepts to my co-colleagues.
So I can get into perceptions a little bit. And what we mean by perceptions, of course, perceptions of time and how they're enshrined in an existing normative order in this case. So, for example, this perception that wartime and peacetime are separate states of international relations, that's a Western perception, right? Where based on a long sort of Western tradition of international law that has sort of become globalized over time and after the Second World War, but is sort of deeply enshrined in like Enlightenment ideas, right? And sort of goes way back in time, where we have this idea that war is the exception and peace is the normal state of affairs. And that in war, then all of the rules that usually apply to peacetime are put out of commission, basically. So that war is the exception. And that's in a way what is enshrined also in the normative framework, the legal normative framework that we have today that regulates when you can go to war in international relations, which again is an exception only in a case of self-defense, for example. And in my part of the book and in this part on perceptions of time, we basically trace how these understandings impact the normative framework and how that in turn then impacts our ability to wage armed conflict today.
Temporality is basically how societies and political orders understand the role of time in their actions. And this is basically the anchoring concept of that goes through the entire book, because the way we understand the role of time define both the trajectories, because we can imagine that there are linear trajectories of time, such as in the Western understanding of time, or cyclical trajectories, right? You come back with the eternal return. And temporality also shapes perceptions. And so in our case, we try to unpack what the specific Western temporality is. And we argue that there has been a bunch of sociological and political changes that have created a specific Western temporality, which is more and more anchored into speed. Speed basically becomes the understandings through which Western societies deal with time, because everything is about accelerating. We accelerate the pace of our social life, but we also accelerate the pace of our daily interactions, the pace of political decisions, right? Where there is this mythology of deciding fast because this idea that faster decisions are more effective, they are more responsive. And it also has an impact on how we wage war. Because if we understand our relationship with time through speed, well, we want to achieve quick victories, right? We will amass, in a sense, resources. We will aggregate means so that, you know, we deliver a powerful initial punch so that we achieve victory in a quick and efficient way. The problem is when our temporality, so the way we understand time, in our case through speed, clashes with what's actually happening on the battlefield, or what is happening, as for example, Amélie explained in her section, with how norms of warfare are developing over time. So temporality is really about how we understand time and how the specific Western understanding of time is overdetermined by speed and how this overdetermination by speed becomes counterproductive.
Thank you. And at each of the end of each of the three sections, you have this kind of scenario essay that asks questions such as, what if the US pulls out of NATO? What if China takes control of Djibouti? And what if digital technologies fail in the battlefield? Why are these scenarios or presenting hypotheticals important to the larger arguments that are being made in the collection?
So we use the scenario chapters to provoke some thinking with the reader who has, you know, been through a section of essays. And so in section one of the book, there are three essays, three chapters, and then the scenario chapter. And the scenario chapter speaks to what we've been through in the other chapters. So in the political section of the book, the West as this unique political force of great international progress. And then we question that. And at the end of the section, Tobias Bunde, in this case, is asking the question, well, could it be that the West is really nothing but the United States? That the West would cease to exist if the United States just let go and said, that's it, we withdraw from world leadership, we withdraw from NATO. Would that put an end to the West? And clearly there's no question the United States is important in the West, but is there a West beyond just the United States? That's what he's asking. And by pondering this question, you know, what if the United States pulled out of NATO? Would that just be the dreadful, brutal end of NATO? Or is there a West beyond the US to pick up the pieces and provide some sort of order? And if the reader, having been, you know, with Tobias Bunde on this journey of wild political imagination, answers, well, you know, if the US pulls out, that would pretty much be the end of it, we're telling the reader, well, in that case, your conception or your idea of the West is really thin. It's all about the US. That's something to ponder.
Yeah, and in section two, so the normative aspects of these things, where we look at this question of what happens if China takes control of parts of Djibouti, what we're asking the reader to do there is basically consider how these normative problems that we've highlighted in the previous three chapters in that section can come together and actually inhibit our response, right? So in a way, what's interesting here is that these normative issues that contemporary warfare has caused for the West, right, where there's clashes between norms, clashes between the need to do something fast, but then actually the fear of being pulled into something that's drawn out in the end, and these questions of where does a conflict start, where does war start, where does war end, right? What is war? What is peace? These type of questions. We're putting that to a test, basically, and we're saying, well, if China plays this right, then the West has a problem based on its own normative clashes, right? And its own sort of normative hesitations. And Ernst Dijkshoorn, who wrote the scenario chapter in part two, basically creates this little story and then asks, so if this happens, if China takes control over parts of Djibouti as a fait accompli, so if they do this speedily, what then is left for the West to do? And in his approach, I think that leaves the reader with a relatively scary image of, well, what is really left, right? Because it is quite questionable that a decision would be made that then could reverse that action taken. And how this plays out, I think, is a very nice illustration to exactly all of these normative clashes that the other chapters address based on other other cases and sort of other focus points.
Yeah, well, when we're discussing the opportunity of having those kind of scenarios, I think the underlying thinking was that, you know, as academics, we have this temptation to be very analytical and try to explain the past and hopefully the present in the most accurate way possible and with proper concepts. But the idea was that also we wanted the book to spark a number of discussions, and we wanted the book to be ideally policy relevant. And we felt that by doing this kind of foresight exercises, which was basically asking the fundamental question of, okay, we are here in 2021, but, you know, try to think ahead in 10 years' time, and do your current assumptions still hold true under a credible scenario? And by trying to provoke this kind of foresight thinking, we were hoping that it will force readers to question their assumptions and increase the policy relevance of the book itself. And in my section on warfare, for example, the scenario is what happens when digital technologies fail on the battlefield. So basically questioning this notion of network-centric warfare, that different sensors and captors will enrich each other and provide a better understanding of what's going on the battlefield. And probably we should have entitled it what happens when digital technologies fail on the battlefield. And because that forces to think about our operations plan, the way we train our soldiers, the way we train our officers to react in such situations. So it was really to try to put ourselves as academics out of our comfort zone, but also hopefully put the reader out of the comfort zone.
Perfect. And let's kind of get into some of those more academic aspects. And we can start with you, Shtin. Can you explain civic militarism and how it relates to the trajectory of Western power?
Certainly. So when we look at the literature on the West and why the West has come to be a predominant political force in international politics, one of the things that scholars can agree to is that there is a unique institutional blend within the West, which is, on the one hand, you have a democratic participatory government where leaders are held accountable, where citizens, are free men and women who are fully involved in their own political destinies. And on the other hand, you have a military establishment that is very capable in war and is capable of amassing the resources of society and challenging it into an organized force for war. So this blend of civic engagement and military force has been very powerful. So the debate is, this blend, which we call civic militarism, because you have both the free citizen and, peace at home. Let's not hit each other and be cruel to each other. Let's be just and good. But on the other hand, you have the instruments of war that you defend yourself, civic militarism. And when that works, you get a lot of resources from society because it's owned by citizens. A lot of resources from society in terms of participation, conscripts, or technology, or innovation, or just finance from society that is being lent to the military instrument organized for external war. And that can become very powerful. And I think the literature reflects that this is what has happened in the West. And then there's a debate on, you know, when, why, and for how long, but let's leave that aside for now. And what we're doing with that concept is saying, well, that concept has a lot of tension built into it as well, because civil society or the civic side of this is really to say peace is the normal condition and progress is our destiny and war is an aberration of sorts. But on the military side, it's not progressive. It's cyclical. War, you know, only the dead have seen the end of war, kind of thing. And it raises the question, where does Western society see itself? Is it that we must learn to live with war and thus ultimately be beholden to a warrior culture? Or is it that, no, we can overcome war. We can make it better tomorrow. War can be, the John Lennon song, you know, I forget now, but you can have peace if you want it, right? If you imagine it, you can have peace. And which one is it? If you confront those questions, you have to choose sides. And the civic militarism equilibrium on which Western power is built does not allow you to choose sides. And so there's the drama for the Western political condition. And what we're asking in this section is, can the West maintain its equilibrium, both civic and military, or is it losing its equilibrium and thus losing its ability to run wars or control wars, restrain war?
And has that equilibrium changed over time? Is that something that's traceable? Is that...
So we go by the literature, and the literature is looking back to the classical age of ancient Greece, when these concepts and this way of thinking, participatory politics, emerged, and it has inspired some people to say that the Western tradition begins there, and it has run ever since. And others say that it began with the modern state some 300-400 years ago, and has thus become differently wedded to industrialization and the growth of Atlantic politics. And yet others say that, well, that's all nice and well, but in fact, it only really happened in the 19th century, and then it lasted for about 100 years, and it's now gone, and the West is history. And so we engage these positions in the debate, and we employ it in an assessment of where we are today. So we're not really taking sides. So some of the authors who contributed chapters, they have their views, and you know, I think it's worthwhile engaging them. But what we do in the section is paint with a broader brush, and then we get to the scenario chapter. You know, what if? And then asking people to ponder the implications hereof and tee themselves up for what Olivier said was also one of the purposes of the book. You know, what would you do if you were a decision maker?
And in section two, Amelie, you write about Western perceptions of time and the international normative order. So I was wondering, what are some of the existing norms and perceptions of time in war, and kind of how have those changed over time as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we start sort of with the basics, and that's how this perception, this Western perception of time and the normative order are connected. And that's basically because the existing normative order of sort of legal and other norms that regulate war and behavior in war is based on this fundamental, as I said in the beginning, this fundamental Western idea that war is the exception and peace is normality, right? And the idea here is that there are certain dynamics going on, right, that are pointing towards a change in the normative order. So you had, for example, Donald Trump as a president who put question marks almost everything when it came to the international normative order, refusing to sign documents that made reference to the international normative order and these type of things. And then you have the emergence of Russia and China, who put forward sort of their own interpretation of these norms, thereby questioning exactly these foundations, right? And you have non-state actors that terrorists, other violent non-state actors that on purpose disregard the norms because, of course, it gives them an advantage to not fight by the rules, right? And we have these new forms of warfare, hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, that exactly play with these normative restrictions, also on purpose to negate sort of conventional military superiority by the West, led by the US, right? Because in a direct sort of fair fight against the US, these actors can't win. So they're not playing by the rules. And all of that comes together to sort of challenge that normative order, right? And being specific about some of the changes that you've asked about, what we're seeing, for example, within the West is that there's both an understanding that the West needs to be able to intervene quickly to protect civilians, for example. So if a state goes in and acts violently against its own civilians, there's a normative understanding that something needs to be done about this, of course, as soon as possible to avoid loss of civilian lives. While at the same time, you have this sort of normative break that you don't want to get bogged down in another drawn-out war. You don't want to, with your actions, make the situation worse, right? You don't want to, with your actions, then contribute to another 10 years of civilian casualties of bombing somewhere. So you have these splits happening within the West. And then you have the split sort of between Russia and China and the West, where you have different perceptions by Russia and by China about how conflict is a much more sort of comprehensive situation going on, where they use political means, economic means, cultural means as part of sort of their more universal approach to being in conflict with the West, while we in the West have this clear distinction between when is a war, right? There's a clear threshold. So if there's the use of armed force, which means physical death and destruction, then we're in a war with the other state. But otherwise, we're not. And we have a different rule set that then applies that doesn't quite allow us to work with these type of conflicts that we're seeing in the gray zone.
And I guess finally, Olivier, you write about time, speed, and military operations. What exactly is the difference between time and speed, and how have these concepts become ingrained so much in Western militaries?
Yeah, exactly. So the last section is really about warfare, so the conduct of military operations. And the core argument from this section that over time, there is a tension in Western warfare because on the one hand, the conduct of military operations is really determined by speed. So we try to achieve effects relatively quickly because this is the kind of indications that politicians and policymakers give to the military, right? And also that because of technological superiority, there is this notion and temptation that we can go faster than the adversary, and if we go faster, we will win earlier and the war will be shorter. But on the other hand, since for the past 30 to 40 years, we have shifted our understanding of what war means to have a much broader understanding of security, in the sense that instead of identifying enemies or adversaries that need to be deterred, we have moved towards a mentality of risks that needs to be managed. A bit of kind of a police activity where you always need to patrol to make sure that no crime is happening. And using the armed forces as a risk management tool is exactly what leads to forever wars, because there is always a risk somewhere. So there is this tension between, on the one hand, trying to achieve quick and fast battlefield effects, and on the other hand, this mentality of using military power as a tool of a global police force or global risk management resource. And something which is really striking is, for example, General Mattis, when he was commanding the 1st Marines Division in Iraq, he said that, I'm quoting here, we knew that the center of gravity was speed, and he says speed equals success, which is very strong when you think in pure Clausewitzian terms. Speed cannot be a center of gravity, right? It's not a weakness per se. So it's very telling that one of the most respected military officers in his generation really emphasizes the role that speed is playing in the conduct of operations in Iraq in 2003. But at the same time, Iraq is exactly the result of the risk management mentality I was talking about earlier, that if you have a bad citizen, you need to police them. And instead, even though there was an emphasis on speed in the conduct of conventional military operations, the US still ended up being bogged down in not a forever war, but for much longer than was initially planned. So this tension between speed in warfare and risk management leading to forever wars is really what this section is really about. And so the different chapters tackle different dimensions. We have a chapter on by Pascal Vincent, who's looking at doctrinal change in the US, the UK, and France, and trying to show how basically doctrine writers have tried to encapsulate in official doctrinal documents this preference for speed, but that the reality of the conduct of military operations always forced Western forces to adapt to actually much longer interventions. There is a chapter by Nina Kollars, who's looking at the different documents from the US services when it comes to multi-domain operations or multi-domain battle, depending on however you want to call it. And she shows that all of them rely on getting faster data and faster information in order to act faster than the enemy, but that they're logically inconsistent with each other. So it might become a problem for joint operations in the long run, because the different services clearly understand the same term in very different ways. And there is also a chapter by Heather Williams on strategic weapons, and trying to counter the hype about new weapons such as, you know, hypervelocity missiles or cyber operations, you know, which allow immediate effects, and showing that this hype about these new speedy or fast weapons, if you want, actually do not really change the fundamentals of strategic challenges and strategic practices such as deterrence and compellence. So she's really arguing that we should take a step back, and it's not because there have been technological improvements that the fundamental logic of you know, nuclear parity and strategic stability is being affected by those technologies. Again, this section is really about this tension between risk management and speed in the conduct of operations.
Hearing Olivier introduce all his chapters makes me want to talk a little bit more about the individual chapters in my section as
yes,
well.
Of course.
Because I only gave sort of an overarching look at the sort of the main topic of the section. But I think it might actually be worth sort of diving a little bit into each of the chapters, just like Olivier has done now for his section, to sort of show how these things really play out when it comes to these normative dynamics that I've been mentioning. And so chapter 5 in the book, the first chapter in section 2, has been written by Kathleen McGinnis. And she actually looks at the norm of civilian protection, so trying to avoid civilian casualty as much as possible. And what she analyzes, she looks at Afghanistan and how that plays out in Afghanistan. And she actually sees a clash of temporalities sort of between the tactical level and the strategic level, where on the tactical level, you have, again, this need for speed that Olivier in his section also looks at, that you need swift battlefield victories and you need to be able to sort of swiftly react and target and all of these things. So things have to go fast. But on a more strategic level, the need to avoid civilian casualties is actually a drawn out process, right? And requires time and it requires careful planning and it requires careful training of local forces as well, that then gets compromised because you need to be quick in producing enough numbers of local forces, right? And that actually leads to sort of a drawn out campaign and thereby increased casualty numbers. And then she also looks at campaign coherence and strategy and how that plays into all of this. So it's very interesting and very enlightening in how sort of these dynamics at different levels come together to end up increasing the number of civilian casualties, even though we're trying to keep them as low as possible. Chapter 6 then by Natasha Court, she looks at norms of intervention and she asks whether Russia and China actually interpret these norms very differently to the West, or whether it is the Western norms themselves that allow Russia and China to sort of have very different perspectives. And she concludes that it is, in fact, divisions within the West on these norms that then allow Russia and China sort of the wiggle room to argue for how they've been arguing, especially Russia, when it, for example, comes to Ukraine. And what they're basically doing is they're using similar arguments to the West against the West then themselves, based on a similar interpretation of norms that is based on this clash within the West of what to do and how to do and when to do it. A little bit along the lines what I've outlined in the beginning, this need to both intervene but not intervene at the same time. And then my own chapter that I wrote together with Peter Viggo Jacobsen looks at this distinction between wartime and peacetime and how that's being played with by Russian and Chinese gray zone warfare, and how that type of warfare is designed to stay under the threshold and thereby sort of slow down the West in its response, right? Because it both allows sort of a high speed of attack when it comes to cyber warfare, for example, and it allows an almost unnoticed number of attacks as well, because we don't quite know what the new normal actually should look like, right? So it's really difficult to establish an attack-free baseline on which then to judge what's actually going on. And all of that sort of comes together to really create this question of whether we can hold on to this distinction. And we come quite firmly down on the side of, yes, we should hold on to this distinction, because some of the peacetime mechanisms that we have actually help us deal with this type of conflict. But I think I'll leave it to the listener to read the chapter and then agree or disagree with us on that.
Yeah, and I, Einstein, yes.
Well, since we're doing a tour to the chapters, let me give me a brief appetizer here, a buffet of section one, where again the overarching concept is civic militarism, and the question is the West able to keep its balance? Can it do both civic society and military society? And we have three chapters that are all saying that, in a sense, politically, we're losing our balance because decision makers are being swept up in military thinking, military affairs, the pragmatic need for certain partnerships or for speed or for quick decisions. And we have the first chapter by Sarah Krebs and Adi Rao. They're looking at the Western state in a 300-400 year perspective, saying that Western decision makers are really undermining themselves by the way they finance wars. Then we have Paul Brister looking at a short time frame, 200 years, reaching the same conclusion, looking at strategy and strategic issues. And we have the final chapter by Rebecca Moore, looking at a much shorter time frame, so last 30 to 40 years, concluding that when we do international operations, we tend to become pragmatic and ally with states that really do not reinforce our values. And so, again, we're becoming too pragmatic for our own good. So we pursue this question of civic militarism in three historical contexts, 300-400 years, 200 years, and 30 to 40 years. All good. So now we did the book. Now we can talk context. Over to you, Carl.
Yeah, and I think it's a fair assessment to say that much of this collection focuses on the problems of Western military power in relation to its people, its institutions, and its operations. So kind of letting our hair down a bit from the academic literature, would you say that these conditions are sustainable? Are they unsustainable? Where do each of you think that the West should go from here? Should we be looking at other places for inspiration? I'm just going to open the floor up to y'all to see what you think about that.
So let me kick that off. We have some policy advice in the end. Broad framework thinking. We're not saying do A, B, and C and everything will be good. But we're saying that definitely the West needs to slow down. And it needs to contextualize its inner drive for always being fast and always being on the move. It needs to contextualize its fascination with technology, that somehow if we have the latest advanced tool, we will win. And we need to spend more time contemplating the human societal side of war. And we're not saying it's a given. And I would say from my perspective, having done the political side, I would say that the West is losing its balance, and it is at risk of not being able to restrain itself by having as a requirement that societies need to be involved in war if you want war to serve political purposes. And you know, we can talk about, you know, why the society tends not to be involved in war, but I think it's important to understand that we need to increase our own pain in war, because pain is what is going to slow us down and cause us to think, can we do this differently? Is there another sustainable way of dealing with the fact that we have armed forces in our societies and that they serve a political purpose? And pain can be, you know, taxing people, or having politicians, defend their values in elections, or commit to international diplomacy and partnerships with like-minded nations. So bring out all the difficult pieces of engaging society in the political decisions and the diplomatic decisions that are so difficult, but ultimately the peace that will restrain war. And if we chase blitzkrieg, lightning wars, because we think we can accelerate to win, to victory, then we will be doing ourselves a disservice.
I guess, yeah, we your overarching understanding that we have is that we cannot accelerate our way to victory, and that in the long run, it becomes unsustainable for Western countries to prosecute war in that fashion. And even speaking to my section on warfare specifically, just the fact that trying to achieve a better balancing between the short term, the immediacy, and the long term objectives will probably lead to a reassessment of a number of policies. For example, military interventions abroad are actually quite taxing for a large number of Western armed forces in terms of providing material, funding such interventions. And it has an impact on how you prepare for the long run, in how you train your officers, in how you acquire new materials that will, you know, help win in the potential massive war in the future. So there is a trade-off between short-term, immediate military interventions and the long-term sustainability of your armed forces, especially in a post-COVID context and a post-financial crisis context, where, you know, we have been in financial slump for the past 13 years now, and it's probably not going to get any better post-COVID. So hard choices will need to be made in terms of do we want to keep adapting to the short term and to threats that are definitely not, I would say, life altering or are not of the level of risking the disappearance of contemporary Western states, or do we want to focus on more long-term resilient and sustainable armed forces that will have the mass, the innovative technologies, and the trained manpower to operate in this new context of, however we want to call it, strategic competition, return of great power competitions, you name it, right? But there is a tension here, which is also related to how we perceive the immediacy, urgency of the short-term issues compared with the long-term issues.
And a similar question actually poses itself in regards to the normative framework as well, I would say, that sort of based on the analysis in that section, what you end up with is basically this question of, I mean, do you consider, as the West, do you consider the existing normative order as outdated and as useless in regards to sort of the enemies that we have, in regards to the challenges that we're facing? Or do you try to actually hold on to it because it does give you a framework for how you can use force effectively and productively also, right? And the coming back to something that Steen said, I think this leaves us with this point that these dynamics need to be discussed and they need to be made visible to so that we first of all can understand how the normative order affects what we can and can't do and how we do things when it comes to war as the West, and also where exactly it is constraining, but also maybe where it is giving us possibilities and identity, and sort of relates back to who we are and how we fight, right? And in that also is a foundation of Western military strength and Western military power as such, right? So it creates this question of, I mean, where do we go from here? Do we accept it as something that's worth preserving, or do we discard it and thus also lose part of the foundation of Western military power per se?
And I guess we can leave those questions for our listeners to answer for themselves. what is next for all of you? What projects are you working on now? What are you working on next? Shtin, would you like to start us off?
Certainly. I actually have a developing project on NATO and Russia and how to combine defense and deterrence, which NATO does fairly well, not perfectly by any means, but fairly well, and diplomacy, and which is, we're really struggling to figure out how do we talk to the Russians and what are we going to talk about? Because they seem to be from another planet, or maybe we are, but we're certainly having a hard time coming to a point of dialogue. And I will look into this type of situation and create and do some historical comparisons to offer some provocative thinking, I hope.
Amelie, would you like to go?
Yeah, sure. So I enjoyed this process of creating an edited volume so much that I'm actually currently working on two more book projects. One is my own, and that sort of focuses on the classification of armed conflict and how sort of these legal categories that we have for when a war is a war are affected by political decision making and political interests, right? And how that then in turn affects the rule sets that we operate under. And then as the second book project is also an edited volume, and that focuses sort of on the roles of fighters and battlefields in contemporary warfare and how these categories become both broader and narrower at the same time and affect each other when we're looking at what war looks like today. And I'm doing that with two of our colleagues, Kirsten Carlson and Marie Robin from the University of Southern Denmark as well. So we're quite excited about that project.
And Olivia.
And I guess that's my turn. I have two short-term and one more longer-term project. As a short-term project, I'm co-authoring an article for a special issue on civil-military relations, but within ministries of defense. So trying to not tackle it through, you know, the broad categories of who are the civilians, who are the military, how does it interact, but how does that play out in the daily life of how ministries of defense are organized. And unsurprisingly, I'm doing the French case. And with a another colleague, we're looking at so it's for another special issue. We're looking at how defense industries adapt to a change in the context of alliances. So looking at the Czech Republic and Estonia, and trying to look at how their defense industries basically shifted from having to produce for the Soviet Union, and how did they manage the turn towards NATO, which has a totally different defense market and also totally different rules for operating. So those two are the short-term project article length. And when I find the time, I try to work a bit on my next book, which hopefully will be a broader conceptualization of military change, because I'm a bit unhappy with the multiplicity of terms that exist. You know, military revolution, military innovation, military adaptation, military change. I think those need conceptual clarification. And I'm going to try to write a book on that. Yeah.
Great. I look forward to all of that. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for being here today.
Yep.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Eric.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us for our discussion of the new essay collection, Wartime, Temporality, and the Decline of Western Military Power, recently published by Brookings Institute Press and Chatham House. Bye for now.